The Guardian.
Don't forget to sign up for free to The Guardian's Global Development Professionals Network, and you could be in with the chance of winning an iPad. Find out more now at guardian.co.uk/win the iPad.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
The cells of our body are quite literally made of information. DNA is an information store, not metaphorically, but literally.
We meet the winner of the Royal Society Winton Prize for Science Books 2012. James Glick's The Information is an epic journey through the science, history and culture of how humans understand and share knowledge. I'll also be joined by The Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample and Observer science editor Robin McKee to look at some of this week's science news, including life under Antarctic lakes and a role for the UK's astronauts in space, possibly. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. We're going to kick off this week's show with news that there's life in an Antarctic lake that's been sealed off from the outside world by a thick sheet of ice for several thousands of years. Joining me to discuss this momentous occasion and many other stories are The Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample and Robin McKee, the Observer science editor. Welcome to you both, gentlemen. Life under Antarctic lakes, much more exciting than the possibility of life on Mars, which there isn't.
How do you know?
I know. Go on, Ian.
Well, this is the discovery of pretty broad groups of broad ecosystem of microbes, bacteria, living in Lake Vida. Now, Lake Vida is an Antarctic lake. It's about 20 meters down, but it's one of the most extraordinary environments on Earth. It's minus 13 C in that pool pretty much all year round. You're not going to get very much light 20 meters down. It's acidic, it's salty. And to find bacteria in there and to find all these groups of bacteria in there, it tells you something about how life manages to find a way in extreme environments. And this is all part of research that is trying to look for almost the edges of existence, if you like. It's like, if you have liquid water, do you always find life? Or are there things that actually make life so hard that you don't get it? And underlying this is really, if you think about how we're looking for signs of life on other planets, a lot of the underlying thinking is if you look for water, you know, this is NASA's big mantra. If you look for water, then the chances are you may find something, you know, life may have emerged there.
And the definitions, as you say, of what life can and can't do have changed in the last couple of decades. Extremophiles not only found in the lakes, as you've just described, but also in hot springs at the bottom of oceans under huge pressure, hundreds of degrees difference between their front and back ends. I mean, these things are surviving on things that, you know, are on very little oxygen down there, and weird chemicals and things. And excitingly, of course, this Lake Vida discovery is just the beginning of all this. The Russians burst into Lake Vostok a few months back. I don't know if they've had published any results from that yet. But also, the British are onto this. Tell us about the Lake Ellsworth project.
Yeah, I didn't realise, but there are more than 360 subglacial lakes in Antarctica. And these are vast, some of these lakes. I mean, there's an interesting... there's a group of British scientists out in Antarctica now. They landed on Sunday, and this week they're going to be getting ready to drill down more than 3 kilometres to a subglacial lake called Lake Ellsworth.
The way they're going to do it is interesting as well.
Yeah, but this body of water is the size of Lake Windermere, and it's one of the smaller ones that you've got out there. And these lakes form when you just get residual heat. You get heating from the Earth's interior that melt the base of the glacier. And so you end up with these isolated bodies of water. This body of water may have been isolated for 1 million years. It's at least 150,000 years old, but the age range is something that they want to nail down. And so you're looking at organisms, if there are any in there, which are certainly surviving without any light at that depth. They have very little in the way of nutrients. They're under about 100 atmospheres of pressure or something like that. These are really extraordinary environments.
And if something survived down there, then that's genuinely interesting because it would have been separated from the rest of the Earth's evolution for, well, let's say 150,000 to 1 million years. And in that time, something significant could have happened to the way that life operates.
Yeah, that's right.
We're not thinking of like fishes down there or something, but you know, maybe very interesting bacteria.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to be finding like blind cave lizards and things like that, but it's going to be microbial. And what will be interesting is, yes, to see, it's not just do you find life, yes or no? It's if you find life, how on earth are they doing it? And what have they adapted to use down there? You know, how are they making use of the chemistry to survive? What is their energy source?
Blind cave lizard. It sounds like an old blues singer. I mean, it's interesting, the fact is, it's not just in these exotic places down there. There's a place in Dorset called Beer, a village of Beer, and they took samples of rock from the cliffs there and ground them up and flew them up on a space shuttle, put them on the outside of the International Space Station for 15 months, brought them back down, and the one species of bacteria survived that, the vacuum, the cold, and the irradiation of, admittedly, there's not that much out there, but still cosmic ray bombardment, and survived 15 months. So you don't have to go that far to find objects, bacteria, extremophiles that can survive amazing conditions.
Where are the microbe liberation front?
Exactly.
In this situation? Yeah. They were just thrown out into space.
They were just sitting there happily.
How do these guys get down to these lakes without contaminating what's down there already? Because, you know, if we're going to bring all sorts of stuff with us.
Well, I had a long conversation with the guy who's heading up the team to do the sterilisation of all of this kit, and I won't take you through all the steps because there are far too many of them, but one step alone, and that there are a good few of them, involves pumping hydrogen peroxide into an enclosed system where all of the components are. And that gets rid of, he said, if you had a million individual bacterium in there, you would expect to have one left standing at the end of that single step. And there are scores of steps which they go through, which involve physical cleaning, heating them up, sterilizing them, various chemicals. And it's an absolutely aggressive procedure that they do. And it's ingenious, actually, what they do.
And by definition, though, the only ones that left would be the extremophiles. So if they found an extremophile, it might just be that after all this, on the end of their drill bit or whatever.
Yeah, but they're doing it in a lab in Southampton. So they're doing it in, you know.
But also what's interesting is the way that the British team are actually going to get down there. They're not going to use a standard drill bit to get through, 3 kilometres of ice or more.
No, that's right. What they do is they have a huge tank of water, which this water is filtered and irradiated with ultraviolet light to zap anything that's in there. So they have an enormous volume of sterile water. And they use this to pump through a hose. And the hose basically has a number of jets on it. One of the jets squirts straight down like a garden hose. And you know, if you put like your thumb over the end of a garden hose, you can get almost a disc of water spraying out sort of around you. They have another nozzle that will do that. So as you drop this hose down into the ground, you have this sort of disc of water blasting out sideways to give you like a radial water pressure. And then one going down to sort of melt the ice as you go down. And you feed this hose down it's a continuous hose. You feed it down more than 3 kilometres. And you can alter the rate at which you drop the hose down and the water pressures and so on. So you can actually be very, very sensitive and very careful about when you reach the point that you're now nudging at the entrance to the lake.
And then once they've got the hole, they get their samples and they've got a day to get the samples before the hole closes.
Yeah,
again.
This is science on a deadline, which is interesting to see, actually. It's interesting to talk to the scientists who are getting a buzz out of being on a deadline, which is something that obviously we're super familiar with. But they have basically 24 hours. It's like a bad cop show. Once the borehole is drilled, they've got 24 hours to get the stuff they need because the borehole freezes up again. So they have, again, ultra-sterile probes that they drop down. And these things weigh nearly half a ton. I'd had no idea how heavy the probes were that they dropped down. These are to collect water from the lake, and the lake itself is about 150 metres deep. So they'll collect water from various depths in the lake, and then they'll also drop corers down to grab sediments from the bottom of that lake, bring it all up, look for signs of life, but also for information about when was that glacier, when was that lake, when did it form, when was the glacier not there, and try and age it and get some impressions of the sort of environmental issues around which that formed.
Let's move the other way into space now. Robin, this is a story you wrote a couple of weeks ago in The Observer about Project Orion, which is an American exploration idea. This is NASA, of course, but potentially with British involvement. Now, we've constantly carped on about the fact that we don't have any British involvement in human spaceflight. I mean, Tim Peake, the astronaut, is an ESA astronaut now, but he's not been to space yet. Tell us about Project Orion and tell us why Britain might be involved. How?
Well, Project Orion is the remains of the American manned space program. The shuttle, of course, has been scrapped. It basically looks like a very large Apollo capsule. So America has gone back to the old stick it on top of a rocket and bang it into space. But it's the capsule itself is not the only part of this package, as it were, that will go into deep space. It will go to an asteroid. It will go to the moon, taking astronauts with it eventually, and possibly ultimately Mars. Now, America is negotiating with private launchers to start supplying the International Space Station with its supplies, its oxygen and its water, its, you know, all the food, etc. This task is currently done by the European Space Agency through its ATV rockets, which have proved to be very successful. They supply the space station. America now wants that to be taken over by private enterprise. It doesn't, so it's looking for a role for the European Space Agency, and it said, well, you made these ATV supply craft. The supply has worked wonderfully. It's got great guidance systems, great propulsion systems. Why don't you use that for our Orion capsule? So America would build the capsule that the astronauts go in, and Europe would build the guidance and propulsion systems. And that looks as if that may well happen. Now, there's no absolute guarantee that you will get a European astronaut on board. But when I interviewed Jean-Jacques Dordain, the head of the European Space Agency, he more or less said, I mean, we ain't going to do it unless we get at least one European astronaut.
Oh, and what about the chances for Britain?
Well, the most recent intake of new ESA astronauts, 7 or 8, I can't remember. I think it's 7 and 1 is a Brit. So that says we've got a chance, at least. You know, they're not training these astronauts for fun. Their aim is to put them in space, and I would say that gives us a real prospect.
It's interesting that what you're talking about is the is beyond low Earth orbit, beyond the yes. International Space Station, and probably worth remembering that the European Space Agency astronauts, including people like Tim Peake, when his time is ready, will still be able to go up on the Soyuz rockets to the International Space Station. But as Robin was talking about, what NASA wants to do is hand over low Earth orbit, which means access to the space station to private industries, and then focus with Orion on cool stuff beyond. And that is where it's going to get really interesting. Do they go to, I mean, there's a lot said about NASA going back to the moon. What they really mean is going to one of these sort of Lagrangian points, like a place where you can essentially sort of hover past the moon and, you know, hang out around there for a while, which would be a really good precursor mission to going to an asteroid.
I'm assuming that's where the monolith is, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Let's look at
L1, there. L2. Yeah. This is where the two monoliths are. No, but seriously, we've kind of lost our way. I mean, NASA sort of lost its way a bit with human space flight after the shuttle was retired. When is all this going to happen?
It's the first flights of Orion of 2017 scheduled. I mean, everything.
2017.
Yes, so things can slip, of course, and probably will.
Given that they've not got a vehicle design, that's quite close.
A vehicle, or do you mean a launcher?
Well, both.
Well, it goes on an Atlas. The low Earth stuff goes on an Atlas, but no, they haven't got a big launcher to get it to the moon. No, they haven't got that yet. But again, they are in talks with Europe. Europe, again, wants to use its expertise in Ariane 5, which is an immense launcher.
Europe's just come along as a sort of very successful getting a bus into space, really.
Yeah, I mean, the point really is, as Dordain said, is that for big manned international space exploration ventures, no country can really do it on its own. Mm. And America isn't going to do this again, go to the moon again on its own. It clearly needs a partner, and Europe's an excellent partner. The question is for Europe, is America an excellent partner? Because they've already pulled out of several missions, including ExoMars, previous missions. You've got to say, I would be thinking a bit carefully about America as a partner.
What about China? Did they mention China in any of this?
Yes. There are Chinese astronauts training in Germany, and all European astronauts are taught Chinese.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And so, you know, everybody's thinking on getting together, which is sensible.
All right. Thank you to Ian Sample and Robin McKee there. For more science news, including an update on what NASA is actually going to announce from their Curiosity rover on December 3rd, go to guardian.co.uk/science. We famously live in the information age, but information has been with us since the dawn of humanity. Ever since we've had society, we've needed information. And the sharing of information has propelled our cultural evolution. Telling the story of all of that is the task that this year's Royal Society Winton Book Prize winner set himself. James Glick is a renowned author and journalist who's previously written about chaos, Isaac Newton and Richard Feynman, although not all in one book. His latest book, the winner of this year's Science Book Prize, is called The Information. He came into the studio the morning after his win to tell me more about it. James, thank you so much for coming into the podcast.
My pleasure.
Fresh from your win, how does it feel to be the best science author for 2012?
Well, thank you. That's ridiculous. I'm very happy that my book won. I don't imagine for a second that it makes me the best science author. You know, there's always a lot of randomness in these things. Also, I have to admit, and I hope this isn't going to suddenly sound ungrateful, I wasn't convinced that this book was a science book in the first place, or even that I'm a science writer. There is science in the book, but there's an awful lot in the book that's absolutely nothing to do with science. And I don't know, these categories are always a little bit artificial, aren't they?
Well, you won the Winton Prize for Science Books, but as you say, the book itself, the information contains a lot more than that. It's a cultural history. It's a history of humanity in many ways. When we were talking about the shortlist in a previous podcast with one of the judges, one of the things I remarked about, because I was reading your book to review, was that you go from Sumerian tablets to iPods and everything in between. And the idea of information permeates everything. So the world is your subject. So my first question, I suppose, is do we take information for granted?
Well, of course we do in some ways, but on the other hand, we're more acutely aware of it than ever before. I guess I wrote the book on with the view that we take it for granted, and that I needed to point some things out that, in many ways, are right in front of our nose, but to say that we're in an information age is to use a cliche that's been around for 50 years, and we hear about information all the time. What got me started on the book was a bit of science, this piece of science that is called information theory that I first heard about more than 20 years ago when I was working on my first book, Chaos, and some of these chaos scientists were studying a dynamical system in terms of Claude Shannon's information theory, a mathematical theory of information. Well, that, if you think about it, that already is kind of extraordinary. And I bought Claude Shannon's book at the time, his little book, The Mathematical Theory of Communication. It was available from a university press. This was before there was such a thing as Amazon, and you couldn't get it in bookstores. And I've carried it around with me, literally and figuratively, over these years. As we have watched information become more and more central to our lives, and I felt that was not a coincidence, that the connections between the science of information and the world of information in which we lived bared some exploration.
It's worth saying who Claude Shannon was a little bit. I mean, he was a mathematician who wrote the book you're talking about in the 50s, late 50s, I believe.
Late
40s. And what might surprise a lot of our listeners, even, who are, you know, experts at using information, I suppose, is that the idea of information as a mathematical concept has only been around since then.
Right.
And we think, well, it must be around forever, right? Information, the word information, meaning what it means today has only been around for that long.
Well, that's it. The idea that information was a thing that scientists could make their business, that already is surprising. And it's worth putting ourselves back into the mindset that existed just barely a half century ago when there was no such thing. When, of course, information as a word is old. You can look it up in the OED, and it's a venerable word with a long history. But it was a vague word. It was news or gossip or instructions, or it wasn't really a very common word. And you can see at a certain point in time, the 20s and 30s, at places like the telephone laboratories, AT&T Bell Labs, in the writings of engineers, you can see them casting about for a way to talk about something general that they were trying to understand. And at the telephone labs, it was the stuff that they were pushing through copper wires. And on the one hand, you could think, well, that's just electricity. They're sending electrical signals through the wires. And you could also say, well, it's electricity, but it is a representation of sound, especially the human voice, in the form of waves. Waves in the air being converted into electrical waves. But we know now that they were doing something much more general, that it was more general, that it could have been the human voice, but it could also have been words. It could have been text, written words. It could have been pictures. The technology of television was just beginning to arrive on the scene in the 1930s. And the telegraph had been around, and there it wasn't waves, it was dots and dashes. But all these things we know very well. They're all the same thing. They're all members of a species which we call information. And that's where it started, when scientists finally, almost by accident, settled on the word information to stand for all of this stuff.
And before then, you talked about, let's call it information with a small I at the beginning rather than the capital I, that it was just gossip, news, whatever else, and has been for thousands and thousands of years before. Let's go right back. I talked about Sumerian tablets. Language is a type of information, of course. We might not have known it to be the mathematical information back that we know now. The printing press democratized information to some extent. Why do we call now? Why is now the information age rather than any of those other times?
Well, that's a very fair question. I would say what we can recognize now is that all human history has been the information age. It's only now that we've recognized it. It's as if we're fish who belatedly discovered that there was such a thing as water. It's always been there. It's always been the medium in which we exist. It's always been the thing that we value most. And that's sort of the point of my book, that now that we're so sophisticated about information, now that we're all information connoisseurs, whether we know it or not, we can look back and reevaluate a lot of things that make more sense now because we can look at them through the prism of the centrality of information. So yes, of course, the printing press was an early information technology, and it was a predecessor of the telegraph and of the radio and of the television and of the computer. All of these things form a sort of line and do the same thing. They enable human beings to record information, make copies of it, preserve it over time, and distribute it across space.
I mean, in a sense, the modern information age is the digital information age. This is what Claude Shannon and others developed over the last half century, is the idea of zeros and ones representing information around us. And before that, the analog information age was, many of them from language to printing to everything else. But when you've got such a rich diversity of material, you could have got written a second volume, really, if you think about how much stuff there is. How do you start to weave a story out of this?
Well, that was a great difficulty, of course. I've written biographies twice, and with a biography, the outline of the story is handed to you on a plate.
And there's a time limit.
There's a time limit, but, you know, biographers have a tendency to get sucked into their material, and a biography, even though you know what the beginning of the story is and you know what the end of the story is, can go on forever and ever. I'm sure you can think of some very, very long biographies. Anyway, this story didn't have such an obvious shape, unless you think all human history is a fair subject for a book. But I started in a way in the middle. I started with Claude Shannon and Bell Labs and the situation as it was in the 1930s and 40s when these ideas were starting to come together. And then I worked backward and forward. I wanted to do sort of manage two narratives at once. One was a narrative that leads up to the formal science of information theory, and that goes back by way of people like Alan Turing, a father of the computer, who, of course, is famous here and has come into his own, even though he was working in secrecy during World War II, and then was treated ignominiously by the British government in the 1950s. Now he's famous as a father of computing, and another father of computing, also English, was Charles Babbage, who was very famous in London society of the 1840s and 50s, and then became completely obscure. He created this giant machine, the difference engine, which you can see in finished form over at the Science Museum, but was never completed in his lifetime. And he also was a progenitor of modern computing. So all of this work led by various channels toward the work of Claude Shannon. But there's another story. There's the story of our human history that goes back even further and involves things like the talking drums of Africa and the transition in human life from purely oral culture to a literate written culture and what that meant for the shapes and forms of our society. And I kind of wanted to tell some of that story too.
In a sense, information and the ways we've codified it before the mathematics has shaped our evolution in terms of how we communicate, how we talk to each other, how society's evolved, essentially. I mean, it's a central part of that. Without information and the communication of it, you wouldn't have society.
Well, of course, that's true. And we've always known that. And it almost seems so obvious as to not be worth mentioning, but...
Well, until you do mention it and point it out, and then you realize that it's all based around something that no one has a clue about. So this is why I asked at the beginning, do we take it for granted? Because it's so inherent, it's so deep as an idea that it's almost, that makes it even more difficult to make people think this is special in some way.
But when you look back at the history of information, you see people confronting the same problems, the same family of problems that we confront today, and we often think they're new. It's certainly new for us to be able to communicate at light speed with people on the opposite side of the globe when a few hundred years ago sending a message to the far side of the globe involved a sailing ship and many months and many hazards and a great deal of uncertainty. On the other hand, the sense that we have so often of information anxiety, that there's too much information, that we are cursed with an inundation of material and grasping for ways to make sense of it, those feelings are not new. And you can see them arriving again and again with every new information technology. When the telegraph arrived in Europe, the electric telegraph, people thought, oh, well, no one's going to be able to keep up now with the speed of communication. And before that, when the printing press arrived, people thought, whoa, too many books. Who can keep up? This is a terrible thing.
I love the detail about the telegraph distorting language in the same way that text messages do now. Those abbreviations, they're not new.
Well, we use the word telegraphese to talk about a kind of abbreviated language, and people were completely conscious of that at the time, that a lot of the long, polite formalisms of language disappeared when you were sending a telegraph because you were paying by the word, and... It cost a lot of money to say please and thank you.
I know you don't go into this deeply in your book, but maybe I thought I'd ask you about this as a general concept. But do you think that information, the idea of structuring knowledge in this particular way, is an innate human thing? This is how we pass the world around us, or at least one version of it. And it was always going to happen that humans would do this.
Well, we are, you know, the species that named itself Homo sapiens, the knowing one. But personally, and I'm no kind of zoologist, I'm always a little dubious of looking for things that make humans utterly unique. And there's certainly no doubt that animals of various kinds use information and transmit information and even record information. Can I defend that? I'm not sure. But also, we need to look more broadly at the role of information in the world. Information doesn't belong to us. Information is, tree rings record information about the weather. The cells of our body are quite literally made of information. DNA is an information store. It's an information transmitting device. It's a code, not metaphorically, but literally. It's an alphabet of four letters containing instructions on how to build an organism. And, of course, DNA predates us lucky humans by many millennia.
But doesn't information need a reader of some sort?
It does and it doesn't.
Otherwise, it's just molecules, just in an order of some sort.
No, I don't think so. I think that's a human-centric point of view. The kind of information that we humans care about, by definition, involves humans at one end of the message or the other. But we're capable of looking at the world in more depth than that and noticing that information predates us. Information is more fundamental than we are. There are physicists now at the edges of quantum theory who are rethinking the formulation of their science, think in terms of quantum information science, and speak of the bit as being a fundamental particle for their world as well. Yes or no questions forming a sort of substrate of the universe that has nothing to do with humans. Also, and connected to that is the notion that there are memes. That's a term that I think our listeners are pretty familiar with now. You know, a meme is a tune that you can't get out of your head, or a cliche, or a piece of fashion that spreads like a virus. And memes are made of information. They are culture. They're units of cultural evolution. And the funny thing about them is that we humans don't necessarily control them. We pass them along, but we aren't necessarily in charge.
The idea of information being something that we said codified in the 60s is interesting, because the science of information turns up around that sort of time and it becomes a mathematical thing. But nowadays, information is science. You mentioned the DNA code. Sequencing the DNA code is an information technology project. Particle physics, the search for the Higgs boson, is essentially sifting through reams of information in particle colliders. When did science itself become this so obsessed with data and information like this?
The story of the actual effect of information theory on the development of science is another piece of my narrative. And it's complicated because science can be used metaphorically, you know, as well as rigorously and mathematically. And that certainly was true of information theory. People started talking about information. Claude Shannon published his influential paper, The Mathematical Theory of Communication, in 1948. And immediately, the word information became a sort of buzzword. And there were scientific meetings all through the 50s. And social scientists started to talk about information. And psychologists would talk about information. And sometimes they were using the word faddishly, and the electrical engineers who thought they owned the subject dismissed that and said, well, that's not really science. We've gotten too trendy for our own good.
The meme had lost control. They've lost control of the meme.
Well, exactly. And as in all of these things, you can misuse science metaphorically, but I also believe that some of the indirect influence of information theory was quite genuine. An example was the development of molecular biology, which was occurring during this time. Crick and Watson discovered the structure of DNA, and they appeared to be solving a chemical problem or a biological problem, but it was also an information problem, and they knew that very well. Now, that doesn't mean that they used the actual mathematics of information theory in their work. nothing like that. But they used the language and the understanding that information was something that existed as a general thing that scientists could deal with. And it is not an accident that the language of genetics today is built on words like code and alphabets and transcription and errors and dictionaries. All of these information words are built into the science because, in fact, genetics is an information science.
You mentioned just earlier about the sort of edges of information now, and so this is what I wanted to talk about next is, we've had the analog information age thousands of years long, digital information is 50 or 60 years old. The next step is, as you said, quantum information. This is a much deeper level of what information is in the universe. If you speak to quantum physicists about this, they say that digital information is crude. It doesn't tell you everything about something. Whereas quantum information, the state of particles, that sort of information is inherent in the fabric of the universe. I don't know if it's possible to sort of talk about this for just a few minutes, but can you give the listeners a little bit of a sense of what it is and where we might be going with that as human beings in terms of, you know, where we might use it even.
This is a fairly speculative area of science, I believe. There's a lot of excitement about quantum information theory. There is a sort of fundamental particle that has been named called the qubit that is I think it was originally a sort of pun, but it's spelled Q-U-B-I-T. And it's an analog of the digital bit in which quantum states come into play. And it is, rather than being fixed, it is probabilistic. And it makes possible, at least in theory, the notion of a quantum computer that would, again, at least in theory, be far more powerful per bit dealt with than a standard non-quantum computer. But it's very early days with this sort of stuff. I don't think when you read about quantum computers in the science journals, they're talking about tiny, tiny devices that that so far haven't been able really to compute anything or accomplish anything. And there's something by definition, difficult about managing them because quantum states are so notoriously, by definition, hard to grasp.
Are we at the stage, do you think, of, you know, where that Babbage was at, where he's theoretically drawing things out for his difference engine but not being able to build it, or finish building it, rather, and in a few hundred years that will be built? Or do you think quantum information still has itself to has to prove itself as an actual thing?
Yes, one or the other. I wouldn't presume to guess which of those possible futures we're headed toward. A glorious future where quantum computers are everywhere and we have the wisdom of gods. Or maybe it will turn out that quantum computing is just too difficult and we aren't able to build those machines. It's too early to tell. All I know is there are a lot of very, very smart people working on this problem.
I mean, it's not just about computing, though, is it? Because quantum mechanics, as you say, is being people try and reformulate it in terms of information. 100 years ago, it's all about wave-particle duality and those sorts of things we might hear about in the history books. But it's much more about information in terms of, as you said, states of particles. And the information layer seems to be much, much deeper in the universe. I always struggle to understand what that means because it's very difficult to sort of get in your head. But if we have this conversation in 100 years or with our descendants, maybe they'll be able to shed some light on it. Who knows?
Well, let's hope so.
Let's hope so. Can I ask you some final questions? What are you going to do with your prize money?
Pay my airfare, my airfare home, I think.
Well, hopefully your publisher will stamp up for some of that. But before you go, can I just ask you, what are you working on next? What's the next prize winner?
It's not going to be a prize winner. I can almost promise that. I'm reluctant to say, is anybody listening to us?
Let's pretend not.
All right. I'm noodling around an idea to do with the history of time travel. That's all I can say about it. So if it pans out, then your hypothetical person 100 years in the future will be able to send a message back to us.
Oh, look, there's one. Thank you very much, James.
Thank you.
Thanks and congratulations to James Glick. His book, The Information, is published by Fourth Estate here in the UK and available at all good book retailers. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Chah, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Don't forget to sign up for free to the Guardian's Global Development Professionals Network, and you could be in with the chance of winning an iPad. Find out more now at guardian.co.uk/win the iPad.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.